In our last session, we saw the prophesied transition from the Babylonian Empire to the Medo-Persian Empire. And we actually have secular records that talk about this event, which helps us to understand better some of the things we saw in the story of Daniel chapter 5 last time. We know that the Medes and Persians gathered around the capital city of Babylon, and the walls would have kept them out because they were very sturdy. But the Medes and the Persians sent a strike team through a water gate and killed the night guard and opened up the gates and took over the city without an awful lot of fighting. Belshazzar was tracked down and killed. Now, he's the second king of the kingdom, the second person in the kingdom, because his father, Nabonidus, is elsewhere in the empire. So Belshazzar is done now, exactly as the writing on the wall had indicated. And chapter 5 of Daniel, verse 31, told us that Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Who this Darius the Mede is not altogether clear in the secular histories. I'm going to give you what I think is the best bringing together of the various bits and pieces. The Chronicle of Nabonidus, which was a Mesopotamian record of these events, says that a general by the name of Gobris or Ugbaru was the point man on the taking of the capital city of Babylon. And that having taken it, a few days later, Cyrus the Persian came with great pomp and circumstance into the city of Babylon. And then he turned around and gave the kingdom of Babylon into the hands of this general, into the hands of this Gubrus or Ugbru, and even gave him the right to select other leadership under himself, satraps that we're going to read about in a little bit. There is further evidence that this Ugbru or Gubrius or Darius the Mede was actually the uncle of Cyrus the Great. And it would appear that this was a reward to him in his later years for serving the growing empire well, that he was basically allowed a few years to be the full-fledged king of the Babylonian Empire. And so that's kind of what we see in the next chapter. Chapter number 6, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom. So as he was granted the power to do so, Darius governed the empire that was the former Babylonian Empire on behalf of Cyrus the Great. And he sets up all this structure, and he has over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one. So Daniel is rewarded himself for being part of the story of the transition, because he predicted that the city would be taken that very night, and it was. So he's rewarded with the position of one of the top three leaders that are over 120 leaders in the, I suppose we should say, the reorganized, fading Babylonian Empire. And it says here that to whom these satraps should give account so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So Darius, over the next few weeks, is so impressed with Daniel, who's older than himself. He's 62. Daniel's got to be in his later 70s, more likely in his early 80s. He's so impressed with him that he's thinking about just declaring him to be the number two man in the kingdom of Darius over Babylon. And that's when trouble starts stirring. Then the presidents, that's the other two guys of the three, and the satraps, that's 120, sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. So they want to discredit him and disqualify him for this idea of making him number two in the kingdom. But the text goes on to say they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful. So he was always doing things properly according to the rules. Now keep in mind that Daniel has been in exile for 67, going on 68 years now. And most of that time, all but a couple of years of it, he has been in high leadership and done an excellent job in it. And so he is the perfect person to be in this position. However, if you want to run things in a way that's beneficial to you personally, which unfortunately many people in government leadership do, you don't want someone like that running things because it will make it very hard to do deals and collect graft and make people pay you in order to get the sweet deals. And so these guys want to get rid of Daniel but can't find a legitimate reason to offer to their new boss, King Darius, for removing him. They could not find ground for the complaint of any fault because he was faithful. No error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." So the other thing they knew about him is he was a very religious Jew. So that becomes now their new target of trying to get him in trouble. And then comes the famous story. Then these presidents, that's the other two guys that he's been serving with, and the satraps, the 120, came by agreement. So we have a conspiracy here. They came by agreement to the king, and they said to him, "O King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom..." Now that's not technically true, because Daniel has not been read in on this little meeting. "All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors," so that's multiple levels that we're talking about here, "are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions." So they want and have already drafted out a law that makes it illegal to petition people or pray to a god other than Darius for a 30-day period in honor of his new position here in the kingdom. This is a vanity law. This is an attempt to stroke his ego, to make him feel like there is no one more important than him, even among the gods. Verse 8, "Now, O king, establish the injunction. Sign the document. It's already written out for you, so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked." Now, this is an interesting aspect of the Medo-Persian Empire of this period. Once a law was written out in clay. They use these little wedge-shaped styluses, and they had wedge-shaped lettering. Once this cuneiform was written out on the still wet tablet of clay and then fired, it was now a permanent law. It could not be altered. It could not have any more changes made to it. And it was put in the into the record halls and had to be enforced. So that's going to come back to bite them a little bit. So, therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. So he allowed himself to be schmoozed into this. He signs off on it. The clay tablet is taken away and fired in a fiery furnace and put into force. Verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he'd done previously. So this was the sneaky bit. These guys knew that Daniel had a habit, a religious habit, that every day at his private residence, he'd get up on the second story and he'd go out with the windows open, get down on his knees, and pray facing Jerusalem. Now, this had apparently become the habit of the religious Jews in exile, that they would face toward the holy city where the temple used to stand and address God, because if they'd been in Jerusalem, they would have faced the temple in order to pray. So he doesn't change his habit. He still keeps doing it as usual, right out there for everybody to see. He petitions God. He asks God to bless him. Verse 11. Then these men came by agreement. They found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into a den of lions? And the king answered and said, yeah, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you've signed, but he makes his petition 3 times a day. So Daniel is breaking your law, which cannot be broken. Now, Daniel was very much loved by King Darius. And that is why the next thing we see in the story is that the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed, and he set his mind to deliver Daniel. So he doesn't want Daniel to be punished for this, because he respects Daniel. He appreciates Daniel. After all, he was about to make Daniel number 2 in the kingdom. And so he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. So he spends the rest of the day trying to come up with a legal loophole that will allow him not to throw Daniel into the lion's den. And then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. So you're stuck, king. You signed the law. The law has been fired in clay. It's in the records, and you can't violate it yourself. You have to throw him in to the lion's den because he appealed to his God 3 times a day as usual. By the way, the 3 times a day, more than likely, were mid-morning at the time of the sacrifice that used to take place in Jerusalem. Mid-afternoon, more than likely, is the other one that is tied in with the sacrificial system of the temple when it was in force. And the other one, more than likely, is middle of the day, noon. And it is interesting that the Jewish people had this custom that was then borrowed, if you would say so, by the Muslims, by basically Muhammad, and added two more times of prayer. And that is in connection with sunrise and in connection with sunset, so that the Muslims had five times of prayer each day. When Muhammad first started his evangelism, he tried to appeal to the Jews to join him in his monotheism, and even had everybody face Jerusalem for the prayer times. But when the Jews saw through his false religion and did not comply, he became very anti-Semitic and not just simply anti-Christian, because he was. Eventually, they started facing Mecca whenever they prayed. So just a little bit of interesting trivia about prayer times and facing a specific city and how that's morphed in one of the false faiths that have come into existence since the time of the apostles. All right, so back to the text. The king is in a mess because he allowed his ego to get him sucked in to this conspiracy. So what else can he do? Verse 16. The king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." So those are his last words to Daniel. Before a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. So how this den works is it's not just some big pit in the ground. It's apparently some sort of cave-like arrangement. It has an entrance that once the person is put inside that entrance, a stone can be rolled in place and a seal is put on it to show that it is not being opened in the meantime. And apparently there is a time limit that's involved here for the execution. That by morning, if he is not dead by the teeth of the lions, then apparently he's going to be released. So it is interesting what the king does during this time period. It says in verse 18 that the king went to his palace and he spent the night fasting. Now, what's usually associated with fasting? That's right, prayer. So he apparently prays through the night, asking the God of Daniel to save him. And no diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. So he's totally unable to sleep, and he's not trying to distract himself with meals and dinner entertainment, musicians, acrobats, none of that stuff. He's just spending the night praying and fasting. Verse 19, then at break of day, so here the time limit is now up. The time limit is not expressly mentioned, but it is clear the way that the king acts that a time limit did exist. The king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And the seal is broken, and the stone is rolled away. And as he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. And the king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" So somehow, again, we're not sure exactly how this thing is arranged, but somehow Daniel is not immediately by the door. He's down in a lower portion of this area, out of sight of the king. And so the king yells for him, wanting to know if he's still alive. And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm." So Daniel is saved. And we love all of the portrayals, all of the imaginations of our mind, of Daniel standing there with lions completely at peace, maybe with an angelic figure nearby, Daniel perhaps praying through the night, and nothing untoward happens to him. And so the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. Apparently, he needs assistance to get up out of the lower area. And once he's up, it says he was taken up out of the den. No kind of harm was found on him because he trusted in his God. So they check him over. His clothing is not ripped. He is not scratched. He's not chewed on. There is not anything to indicate the lions did any bit of harm to him whatsoever. And then the king decides to invoke a reciprocal law that existed in the Middle East. Even the Jewish people had this law. And that was basically this: if you falsely bear witness against someone to try to get them in trouble, whatever it is that you tried to have done to them because of your perjury, because of your duplicity, because of your bribery, that will now be done to you. So a reciprocal or boomerang law. And so the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lion. They, their children, and their wives. Now, of course, Jewish law said that children could not be executed for the crimes of their fathers, but this is Upper Middle East. This is Medo-Persian law. And so apparently the whole family was done in. Before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So the lions were very hungry and very ready to maul and consume anyone that came down into the lower portion of their pit. And that's exactly what happened to the troublemakers, the conspirators that had tried to take Daniel out of the equation just because they wanted to take positions of authority to their own benefit. And what does Darius do? It says, King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. So he writes to everybody that's in his kingdom. Now remember, he is apparently the uncle of Cyrus the Persian, the king over the growing Medo-Persian Empire. But King Darius has been granted the Babylonian kingdom as a reward for his service to the Medo-Persian Empire. So he writes to all of his a kingdom, which is made up of multiple nations, multiple ethnic groups, multiple languages, including the Jewish people. And this is the message he passes on. Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. So he makes the Jewish faith a protected faith. For he is the living God, enduring forever. Now, we don't know if this marks the conversion of Darius. That will be interesting to find out in eternity, won't it? But his language certainly shows a high, spectacular respect for he who is. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to and his dominion shall be to the end. That means it will be enduring forever. This is language from elsewhere in the book of Daniel. Many of these passages are recorded as testimony that God himself, the Ancient of Days, and his Son of Man, that would be Jesus, are the eternal sovereigns of heaven and earth. And so here is Darius bearing that testimony. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So the story of Daniel shoots out over the entire kingdom. And everybody knows that Daniel's God is a powerful God. And the religion of the Jews is to be highly respected. And so verse 28 reports, this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, which is only going to be another year and a half, maybe two calendar years at the most, and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Because we know historically that when Darius the Mede dies in the next year, 538 BC, that Cyrus the Persian takes the title King of Babylon into his multiple titles. And that becomes his first year as being king over the Jewish peoples. And Daniel will be serving him at that time. And that sets up the story for our next Daniel vision, which is going to be Daniel chapter 9. And so I want you to read that chapter between now and tomorrow, because there's a lot in it that we need to take very seriously and digest about the future of the Jewish people.